You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
From Feature Story News in Brussels, I'm William Denslow. A contingent of 100 US Air Force personnel has arrived in Venezuela to help repair the earthquake-damaged airport in Caracas, as the death toll from last week's twin quakes rose to 1,450. Residents in the worst-hit areas say they've been left largely to fend for themselves. Catherine Ellis is a reporter in Caracas.
People there are telling me, even in some areas, that today is the first day they've actually seen government authorities actually there. A lot of people are actually just using their bare hands or spades to try and get to people that they know that are still trapped underneath, basically. To begin with, there was just panic and anguish and trying to look for people. But as the days have gone on, definitely in the last couple of days, people are getting very frustrated and very angry.
Pakistan's carried out overnight airstrikes and ground operations inside Afghanistan. Local officials claim at least 36 civilians have been killed. Islamabad says the strikes were a direct response.
A Taliban faction on a ranger's camp that killed three security personnel and three militants and injured four others. Afghanistan has condemned the strikes, with spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid accusing Pakistan of hitting civilian areas. Tensions between the two countries have remained high since 2021, with Islamabad alleging Afghan soil is used for attacks, a charge Kabul denies.
A senior Trump administration official says the US and Iran are still talking, with technical discussions on implementing the memorandum of understanding expected, despite the two sides exchanging strikes over recent days. The Revolutionary Guards warned that violating the ceasefire will lead to a complete halt of the diplomatic process. Analysts say US President Donald Trump faces mounting pressure to keep negotiations on track ahead of November's midterm elections. From Washington, Alistair D'Souza reports.
Trump wants this war in Iran over with. After all, a closed Strait of Hormuz means those higher prices at the pump, and that is not the economic story that Trump wants to be telling heading into the midterms in November. He needs trade flowing. He really needs some sort of win to sell to voters. So despite all this fire and fury, analysts say that Trump still has every incentive, really, to keep talking.
And senior EU and Chinese officials are holding talks today in an effort to de-escalate rising trade tensions. The EU's good trades deficit with China hit around $412 billion last year. And European leaders recently instructed the European Commission to draw up proposals to better protect the bloc's economic interests. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, with more today on the life and death struggle continuing in Venezuela to try and reach people trapped in the rubble of last week's twin earthquakes. Tens of thousands of people are still missing. The devastation is so substantial that many buildings in the capital Caracas have still not had any rubble removed, and with each passing hour, hope fades that survivors can still be found. Finley Adams-Brown is a global disaster management coordinator working in the humanitarian aid sector.
It's a critical situation already, a country in a region that's depleted on resources, and then add into the midst of that two earthquakes of the likes that haven't been seen for over a century. And also it's the depth of those earthquakes. They're reported as shallow, meaning that energy is far more present than a far deeper one, which the energy may have dissipated. So what that looks like from an impact on infrastructure, hospitals, water, sanitation, etc., is substantial. And the population that are affected, you're looking at half of the Venezuelan population of approximately 30 million, 16 million of those will have felt the impact of the initial earthquakes, but also the tremors felt since.
More than 30 international search and rescue teams are working in the rubble, while the US has committed $150 million in aid and is preparing a further package worth hundreds of millions more.
The main news again. A contingent of 100 US Air Force personnel has arrived in Venezuela to help repair the earthquake-damaged airport in Caracas. Comes as the death toll from last week's twin quakes rose to 1,450. Pakistan's carried out overnight airstrikes and ground operations inside Afghanistan. Local officials claim at least 36 civilians have been killed. And senior EU and Chinese officials are holding talks today in an effort to de-escalate rising trade tensions. And that's the latest feature story news. William Denslow reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. After a foggy start, mostly sunny today. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high near 87. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight. More fog developing toward daybreak on Tuesday. We'll have partly cloudy skies with a low around 68. Scattered showers and thunderstorms late in the day on Tuesday. We'll see a high top out near 89. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country, sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville Independent Commercial Free Radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant, and behavioral health expert. And with me today is Khalil McCarty. A child and family therapist in Bellingham, Washington, there on the coast, down from the Cascade Mountains, right? She earned her master's in mental health and wellness and school counseling from New York University and is a board-certified autism specialist and assessment professional. Khalil specializes in working with neurodiverse individuals, including those diagnosed with autism, ADHD, pediatric bipolar disorder, mood disorders, PDA, for those who don't know, the pathological demand avoidance, and complex co-occurring conditions, including medical complexities, which is, we'll get into that a little bit later, bringing expertise in behavioral analysis, developmental disabilities, trauma-informed care, and psychotherapy for children and adolescents up to age 17, but works with the adults and the families as well. Over the course of her career, she has worked across community agencies, courts, schools, wraparound services, and other mental health programs, to some frustration, I imagine. In her practice, she takes an eclectic, individualized approach rooted in connection and understanding, helping children, youth, and their families rebuild foundations and thrive. She is a strong believer in client voice, safety, and self-advocacy. Khalil has found that art, play, and storytelling are among her most powerful tools in her work, evidence-based modalities that meet kids where they are and form the foundation for lasting healing. On the horizon for Khalil is also collaborating to open NeuroBloom, a therapeutic center for the neurodivergent population there locally. That sounds very exciting. Khalil, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I spend a lot of time in this world finding resources for people. So trying to find people like you for people who need them. A lot of times they're bouncing around the country because they're in crisis when they get to us, and they're looking for residential care or those kinds of things. But then they have to land again, and then they have to come back home. A lot of times, if you can, you also try to avoid going to treatment. But people wait long, as you've seen, they wait long enough to be in crisis because they didn't know what to do. And it sounds like part of your work is, you're finding individuals when they're reaching the first initial stages of, we don't know what to do anymore with our neurodivergent child. What is it that got you into that work in the first place? Like, how did you come into that?
Yeah, you're right. Like, they do, they end up reaching me kind of at that point. They've seen so many professionals and they've had bad experiences, or they feel really invalidated by a lot of professionals they've seen, and they don't know where to go next. And I think what got me into this point was also like my own lived experience of feeling that same invalidation, like not only through seeing professionals for help for myself, but also for my kids, and just feeling like I want there to be someone out there who was providing services who didn't get met with those same reactions. Like, I wanted to be able to be out there and help people and be that affirming resource. And not that I felt like I could go help everyone in the world, but I kept needing these resources that were so unhelpful. Or like when my kids were diagnosed specifically as autistic, I just got this letter, was handed this folder, and then was like, you should probably go seek out ABA. And then they were like, bye. And I was like, wait, what do I do next? Like, what does this mean?
Seek out who? What?
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, what? And I was just like, this is so not how this should go. And at that time, I did have my therapy license, but I didn't really have a niche. I was just getting into it. And I was like, I want to change this. I want to make this better. And so that was really how I got going. And, you know, not actually knowing at that time that I was autistic, I just did my very autistic thing. And I just went into this deep dive. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, I have, you know, umpteen clock hours into, you know, autistic specializations and all of these other things. And I was so deep down that rabbit hole, and now I'm here.
Well, and you know, you kind of did what a lot of parents will do, is they'll dive into this rabbit hole. But you know, you had a license at the time, so at least you had a grounding and understanding, you know, clinical concepts and treatment in general and so on, which helps you like, well, no, that's not what I'm looking for, and that sounds like what I'm looking for.
Absolutely.
And these resources don't have enough, but this one over here, most people don't have that ability to differentiate. And they it's hard for them to feel guided by diving into the internet. You know, we call it the Google consultant sometimes. What is it that you like, how do you do that with families when they come to see you? Mm-hmm. So they're coming to you, right? And they're running into the bricks at home and they don't know what to do anymore. Mom, probably, it's usually mom, not always mom, but a lot of times it's mom, that has gone into the Google and they've somehow found you. How do you tell them about working with their child without overwhelming them with all the information that's out there about neurodivergence?
Well, for the longest time, I had like a resource sheet that I kind of like bullet pointed things and broke it down. But I was tired of like reworking that over and over again. So actually last year, I published a book. And my book is called Naturally Divergent. And it kind of has like these main bullet points. And it came out in September 2025. But what I did in this book was I kind of took these like one-liners that I would tell families that really like took the meat of something that are these concepts that we do want to teach families that help them kind of bring these therapeutic processes and these evidence-based practices that help them actually apply them at home. Because I think that's one thing that they would miss a lot is like they would get these pieces of information and they wouldn't really understand the application at home. So they would hear like, oh, do this or do that. But like the application was never really explained to them. And so it was a lot about how can I do this right now? How can I start this right now? So for instance, like with PDA specifically, like you said, the pathological demand avoidance, it's a very specific application. And if you do it any other way, literally you are going to set off your child's nervous system. And so what I did in my book was I created this one-liner and I literally call it Cleo's one-liner for success. And it's literally creating structure and like rules without that demand and rigidity that creates that set off for the nervous system. And so what it is, and I actually helped the PDA North America organization create a little blog. And so you can actually read about it there too, is create this like visual for parents where what you're doing is you're creating a box that you're putting your kiddo in. And you allow them to work within the box and they have that freedom.
They don't know they're in a box.
But they don't know they're in a box. Exactly. But it's that safety. It's a safety net. But they get to work within the box and they feel free. And you feel safe as the parent because you know that they're not going to go outside of that box. And so these are the kinds of things that I feel like we have to break down as therapists or as doctors or whatever professional you are to truly help parents adults, if you're trying to navigate your own needs, help them actually take what we're telling them and then apply it in their home.
Yeah. part of what has we've seen in advances in residential care is one of the things that was a limitation of residential care was that, you know, they did really great, you know, kids did really great in residential care, right? Mm-hmm. But they couldn't take it home.
Yeah.
You know, they get home and they didn't, you know, they didn't know how to apply it. Parents didn't have any education. If you go to programs now, a lot there, you know, there's a lot of parent involvement. They're using tools like having shared language, you know, how they name things, how they ask questions, how they do things, giving them the structure that they could work with and some practice using it as well. So it's a, you know, and it's an incredibly valuable resource that I'm glad that you've created. I remember being in the field for the first time working with kids and being introduced to a processing model for how you know, ask questions and help kids make choices and redirect and so on. And it's an art. I mean, it really is an art. You know, there's a structure to it, sure, but you got to also, when you're at home, you got to kind of live outside that structure a little bit, get creative, kind of understand it in principle and practice, not just as a mechanism. And what are you able to do? Like, what are you doing in your work with families that allows them to, that gets them to practice? Like, what are you seeing and how are you getting them to practice? And what are the results looking like when they do?
Yeah. I honestly incorporate that in like PCIT therapy. So that's the parent-child interactive therapy. And a lot of times when we think about it, we think of this as only play therapy, but I actually love to use it and incorporate it into something like what you're saying, where we actually kind of teach them how they're going to do something like in a home environment. So like if we're doing something and they are wondering, okay, how are we going to incorporate this in the home? We can actually teach them in more of a natural way rather than like when, especially with teens, right? They feel like so awkward with the role play, right? And they're like, oh, I don't want to role play. That's so awkward. And you're like, yeah, of course. Like, that's so gross. Ew. And then, you know, if you agree with them, they're like, yeah. And then they start doing something that they would do, right? Whether they're playing, I love them to like,
this is gross, let me show you.
Yeah, exactly. Right. This is gross, let me show you. And so like, if they have their, you know, their game on their phone or something, I'm like, here, show me a game you're playing on your phone. And so they start showing me a game they're playing on their phone, right? And then all of a sudden, I'll give a demand. And I'll say like, oh, can you switch to this game instead? And they're like, no, I hate that game. And then all of a sudden, I will literally demonstrate what we would want to do in the home. And I'll go through the flow chart and I will explain to the parent what we're doing. And the kid literally has no idea that we're showing it exactly as is. They think we're just having a conversation. And then I will hand it over to the parent. And if they say something that we don't want to do, that's that child parent-child interactive therapy where I'm now coaching them through it. And so that's kind of how we do this. And the child is just kind of sitting there like, I just want to play my game. Right.
You're using their social processing limitations to your advantage.
Exactly.
At that time. Right.
Exactly.
That's great. That's fantastic. And do you find any parents picking up on it? Like how's that working? Do they really, are they coming home with coming back with stories like, wow, this worked. Like, you know, like what's their, what are the stories that are coming at you?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I think this is part of like, you know, for the longest time, I kind of was made to feel like my autism, ADHD was kind of like not a strength and, you know, that I shouldn't
superpower.
Like,
what are you talking about?
that I shouldn't tell people. And what I found is that the way that I explain things like this, and I do it in practice, it's how my brain works. And I found that so many people have enjoyed it because exactly this, they'll come back and they'll go, thank you for explaining it like this. This is the first time I felt confident going home and doing this with my kid. And they come back and they say these things. And I go, okay, I feel like I explained it well enough that I was able to communicate this in a good way. And yeah, they come back and do this. And for the longest time, I didn't explain it this way. I did it the way I was taught in school, you know, or I was told that you're not supposed to use you're not supposed to talk about yourself too much, things like that. And it never felt right. I didn't feel like I got good feedback. And then I kind of started just doing it my way. And all of a sudden, this is where I'm getting the good feedback. I'm hearing that they were able to incorporate it in their home. They're coming back, giving me good stories. And so I'm glad that I was able to kind of get over that piece a little bit and say, you know, I'm going to do it the way that makes me feel more comfortable. And the more comfortable I felt, the better results I'm actually giving to the families. And they're coming back, giving me good feedback, which means
they're getting confident and feeling comfortable, which makes it work, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of brings me, you know, I see therapists and programs for that matter. So I got a couple of topics that I want to talk about that live on the fringes, which is, I got to see Stephen Hayes, and he sat there in front of like 500 clinicians and told them that their evidence-based practices were BS. He was not friendly about it. It was hilarious. And I thought it was great because I think research and evidence-based practices, it has its value, right? Just because you've been doing something a long time and studying it for a long time doesn't necessarily mean that it's a great practice. And it sounds like what you've done is taken a platform of what you think is what we find is reliable evidence-based practice, right? Mm-hmm. But you've taken it to a level that is your own, that you've taken things that maybe you were even advised not to do as a young therapist. And now you're like, no, actually, me telling a personal story is a good thing. And personalizing the care that I'm doing with this individual helps us share a connection, and that connection makes us effective. What would you tell young therapists coming into the world? Because you also talked about, like, you know, bad services and bad care and people who have been traumatized by the care professionals that they've interacted with. What would you say to young therapists coming into the field about the field that they're coming into and how to navigate it with some level of clarity, some level of discernment about the practice they're engaging in? What's the advice you would give?
I would say to them that there's a reason that every therapist is unique. And there's a reason there's so many of us out here, because not every client is going to work for you, and you aren't going to work for every client. And if it isn't a good match, that's okay. And then I'm also going to say that just because I did that with one client doesn't necessarily mean that would work for the next client. So maybe I might share a personal story because I know that that's going to work with one client, but maybe my next client, I know that sharing that personal story may not be the right thing. And I explain it completely differently with the next client because I understand that their type of learning is very different. And so I think it's all about really knowing your clients and asking them like the best ways that they learn, and really understanding how to make it truly affirming for each client you see. And I think one of the most harmful things that happens in our current education system all throughout is that idea that one size fits all. And everything this even happens, right? And this even happens when you go through school to get trained as a counselor, a therapist, which is that this is an evidence-based practice. This is the level, and this is how you do it. And you can't be doing that for each person that walks through your door. We can't give them the same type of therapy and do it the exact same way and deliver it the same way to every person. Because if we're going to truly be affirming, each person is literally going to be given something differently every time they walk through. And the same client is going to come and present differently every day they walk into you. And you have to be ready for that.
Yeah. How do you develop that kind of, I mean, you're talking about clinical discernment, right? So what is it that helps a person? I think part of clinical discernment is also, there's a couple of things at the base, which is, you know, not that you don't have an ego, but you get the ego out of the way. Mm-hmm. I might not be right for, you know, for a therapist to admit that they might not be right for a person, or I need a different tool and I'm not sure what that is. Like to have a question live in your mind, like, I'm not sure where to go with this and I need to find out more. Like, how did you get to the place where you cultivated that level of discernment in your practice?
I had an amazing professor that I got to be with in a lot of my trauma courses when I was at NYU. Right. And she, like, literally every time we were in class would remind us that, you know, again, there are tons of therapists out there for a reason. And there's no way that you can help every person in this field. And you need to remember that, even though you came into this field because you want to help everybody, that if you ever tried to do that, you would run yourself into the ground. And if you do that, you're not a good therapist. And
you might run them into the ground too, you know.
And so she would say that all the time, and it helped because yes, I'm a big softie. I'm always going to say I have room for more, right? Like that is definitely one of my downfalls, and it's something that I have to constantly remind myself. And something that I do just as a personal check is that if I have anxiety, and that's a good kind of anxiety with a client, I need to do that self-check of like, am I working with this person in a good capacity? Because if not, we're not a good fit.
Right. Absolutely. Well, it just sounds like staying grounded, you know, in your professional practice is really, and you've gotten good guidance along the way in getting that done. The other topic that I want to bring up, because this is something we see on our side of things as well, and something where people have gotten disappointing responses from other care providers, which is addressing medical complexities. Mm-hmm. When you've got a client, you got a child, family, and the child has, maybe they have a diagnosis, maybe it's a, you know, they're on the spectrum, maybe they have ADHD or both or what have you, but they've also got these other co-occurring, you know, pretty significant medical conditions. And maybe it's a thyroid issue or maybe, I mean, heck, for, you know, adults, you've got, maybe it's MS or maybe it's these things that impact a person's mental health. You know, they just do. How do you incorporate like that into your practice? One of the things that we see is everybody runs in silos. So the medical doesn't talk to the psychological and vice versa. So finding a practitioner that can really kind of look at it all and be like, well, you know, this condition actually causes these things. Mm-hmm. How did you start incorporating that into your practice and what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm not a doctor, so I don't have medical training exactly, but I've done a lot of trainings that talk about, you know, how they're connected. And I do have a lot of, you know, what we call like clock hours, right? Where we really look at how they connect, as you said, and how they really are intertwined. There's a lot of new information out lately about how neurodivergent neurotypes have a very different medical makeup, and mm-hmm. how it really changes the dynamic and what's going on with them. And so that is something that I've really been continuing to discuss. The way that we really look at it is if parents are telling me, you know, that they're seeing these symptoms, I really encourage them and help them advocate for just working with their doctors. I let them know, hey, like, let's just look at these things. I give them information. If they feel like they're not being heard by their doctor, I just help them like with information that they could advocate for. I help them with sending them articles, things that they could show their doctor. You know, again, I really do make sure to be careful of how I'm walking that line. I don't want them to
stay in your lane,
you know,
right?
Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, like as mental health professionals, we still get to advocate and help them. I do very much try to stay connected with their doctor. I really try to, you know, be that person that can help connect a little bit and provide information if possible. You know, there's a lot of connection with PANS and PANDAs with young kids. And so when we're doing assessments for young children, and we're looking at like the sudden onset of symptoms around OCD, like, you know, there's a lot more connection that we need to do around that. And so those are things that we've been really focused on lately. And so I think that there's a lot more connection, especially around children, that us mental health professionals, psychiatric providers and doctors have been doing, especially when we're looking at assessments. And I think that's why the mental health professionals, especially like in our state here, have been advocating for more connection when it does come to diagnosing.
Well, I mean, I think that's the largest problem people face when they get inadequate care is that You know, when you've got providers who are not really good at their job, that happens, yeah. Right? Especially in state sadly. Systems. I mean, honestly, that's where we see a lot of it, hospitals and state systems. But more importantly, you also see that they're siloed. They don't. You've got teams of people that are treating a person. You got a psychiatrist, you got a doc, you got a therapist, and that's a team, and they're not talking to one another. The advantage mm-hmm. that you see in treatment is that you've got all those people actually talking to one another all the time. And parents also feel like they have a voice when they're talking to the providers. And they're saying, well, you know, we've got this. And, you know, and for a psychiatrist that's not talking to the medical doctor, especially if there's a co-occurring medical issue, you know, there are a lot of psychiatrists out there who just dump meds on kids. You know, they're symptom chasing. That's what they're doing. It's like, well, they're depressed or they're anxious or they're, you know, have ADHD and they're all over the place. It's like, let's give them something to calm down. Let's get them something to stir up. Let's get them something to concentrate. Let's do all of those things at once. And suddenly you've got a 16-year-old on 8 meds. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that alone will give you some medical conditions if you're not watching out for it. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that it sounds to me like you and I would agree on this statement that in an ideal world would be a lot more intentional. And a lot more collaborative in our approach to care.
Absolutely.
Which kind of brings me to the center that you're opening. Your website does not do you justice. You've got a book out there. You're opening a center. Like, there's all these cool things that you're doing. And I had no idea. So now I want to ask a little bit about NeuroBloom. The center that it's open. It's about to open. Where are you at in the stages for that?
Yeah, our grand opening is September 19th. Right. And when I say we, it's family owned. So it's me and my husband, and we're really, really excited. Right. My brainchild. I'm so excited about it. And so it'll have providers. So we have an amazing SLP joining us, who's a feeding specialist, in office. We have myself and then another mental health specialist who also specializes in special education needs. And then we're going to have a women's practitioner, ARNP, coming in. And then we're on the lookout for prescribers. We need a couple to come on in. We're still looking for a unicorn prescriber. So if you know of anyone, let me know.
Okay. you've got the complement of medical, you've got psychiatric, mm-hmm. you're looking for psychiatric, you're looking for a prescriber,
you've got
clinicians, you're building something that's breaking down these silo walls that we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. And this is also, you know, to stop that kind of that pipeline of sending out disabled and or neurodivergent individuals to places where they don't exactly know the mission or values of those providers. And then we end up sending them out and they get traumatized. And so we're also hoping to kind of stop that chain as well, right? Where they mm-hmm. know the type of providers they're seeing. They know that they share the values of, you know, they're neuroaffirming, they have backgrounds in either neurodivergence, disability, LGBTQIAF2+, like they have all of those needs. And so they know who they're going to see. They're trusted providers, they're vetted, right? And so that's kind of what we can provide for them. And then the community center part, we're going to have a sensory gym. So this is like all the equipment you would see at like an occupational therapist or a physical therapist, right? So like sensory swings, gym equipment, like if you really like your body being squeezed, we have like different equipment that squeezes your body. Or if you like to go and do sensory play, we're going to have like an area where there's water tables, sand tables, ways to explore sensory in your own avenue. And so we have different setups for different age and movement capabilities. And it's going to also make it so that there aren't tons of people around. There's hour signups. So like we're going to have about 15 people per area per hour. So that's kind of so that we can keep the visual noise, the actual loud noises down. We have a game room where there's going to be like a pool table and tech so people can play on computers, BSs, those kinds of things. And then we're going to have a library. So there's going to be two avenues for the library. You can just sit there, read, lend the books that we have. And then there's also going to be a purchasing where we're bringing in marginalized authors, marginalized resources, where like you can't get these books at Barnes and Noble and everything because they don't highlight resources for neurodivergent, disabled, LGBTQIA plus resources. And we're going to have those all there from authors who are part of these groups that don't get their books published at, or I mean, held at.
They don't sit on the shelves at Barnes and Noble with the 50% off and the big table. Right. Exactly.
Exactly. And so we're going to have those there and they can grab them and buy them and they'll be easily accessible. And our entire, we'll also have a fit, like a gym, a fitness, a workout place just to keep your body healthy. And it'll have equipment that's ADA accessible, as well as, you know, things for individuals like, you know, if you wear Down syndrome, it's hard to go work out at our local gyms. They don't have equipment that's specially made for somebody who might just want to work on their muscle tone or things like that. And it also sometimes can be just intimidating. That's what I've heard feedback from some of our population.
Overstimulating. Yep.
Overstimulating. Yes. The lights. Oh my gosh.
It's overstimulating to me. I mean, you know what I mean?
Same. And so we're just going to create a little bit better environment, more inclusive, really just have our individuals of our community really built at the center. And then my personal favorite, we're going to have a very small cafe, just coffee and some baked goods. And these baked goods are celiac friendly because I have celiac disease and there's nowhere in our area I can eat. And so we're going to have like, yes, we are going to have cinnamon rolls. We are going to have some muffins, bagels, and I am freaking excited about that.
You're just doing this so you have a cafe you can go to, right?
Exactly. I'm just doing this whole center. It's just so I can eat cinnamon rolls.
Right. That's a good, I mean, you know, that's a good cause. I think eating cinnamon rolls, that's a good cause.
Exactly.
Well, that's really exciting for you. I'm, you know, when I get out that way, I hope to, you know, I know you're just across the water from Victoria, Canada, if I'm not mistaken, or BC,
yes.
Rather. Yeah.
Yes, we are.
And I plan a trip out that way. I get to Washington, I don't know, once, maybe twice a year if I can. There's a few programs out that way that we take a look at, but I'll steer it towards the time when you're going to be opening the center, so we'll have to stay in touch about that. I like going out and seeing people's like cool new stuff and, you know, the sensory rooms and things like that. It's pretty neat. You're a parent, you got a child that's on the spectrum. You have experience with living on the spectrum yourself. You had some grounding experientially in the neurodivergent world, which gave you probably, to a certain extent, some advantages in navigating it when you were finding care.
Yeah.
When you've got a parent, if you got a parent out there, just, you know, for the listeners, you got a parent out there that's on the fringes of identifying what's going on with their child, determining that they are on the spectrum, or they've got a condition that requires care, that requires help and support. They're kind of doing the I don't know what to do now thing. What's advice you would give to that parent?
Ooh. It's hard to pick like just one, but I think honestly, like the first thing I would do, because what happens, I think, the most is that our kids that are, you know, diagnosed autistic, when we are struggling the most is when we are forcing not only ourselves, but our kids to do things that are not natural to their own system because we're trying to fit into social norms. So I think what I would say is follow your child's lead and follow your own lead. Do what is more natural to them and you. Like, for instance, a really great example is if dinner time is like really chaotic and stressful, and it's easier to not have like everybody sitting at the table and you guys are like eating staggered or someone's eating on the couch and someone else is eating in the kitchen because you guys don't like hearing each other chew, do it. It's okay. Like, if protect your peace, because that's way more important than going to a friend's house on Saturday and saying that you all had a quality dinner time. Like, right. I think that's what I end up talking to parents about most. Yeah, like, that's what I think I end up talking to families about most is letting go of the societal expectations or doing it how you grew up or how you expected it to go. And I'm not saying that letting go of those things is easy or it like feels natural. But I would say that that's the first go-to, is that whatever you think you're or feels like a battle, don't battle it anymore. Let it go. It's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a choose your battles things, but I think you're also talking about breaking down societal norms and deciding what's actually important. And deciding what you want the outcome to be. The outcome is, you know, I want as healthy and happy a child as I can have. I want, you know, I want my home to be a place of refuge. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be able to rest in my own home. And if you're trying to put the square peg in round holes and it's making your home, you know, unstable and not a place of refuge, then maybe you need to rethink the entire equation for a second.
Exactly.
And, you know, just because you did it as a kid doesn't necessarily mean that you could, you know, and maybe you negotiate. Maybe you want to have the family at the table one night a week. And everybody can, like, they can work it out for one night a week.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I think that it requires people to get creative. I really do.
Totally.
Like, parents feel like they're, you know, they say they haven't written a book about it. It's like, well, there's lots of books out there, but it doesn't land. But it, you know, it's hard to take a book and land it and practice in the home, just like you're, you know, so you've got to get creative. I'd say the other thing is get help, like find somebody like Khalil and have her guide you through what to do. Like, don't be afraid to get help. I think we're better at it now as a society, but you know, so many people just don't go get help. They like, oh no, it's fine. We're going to handle it on our own, right? Until it really starts becoming more than they can handle. I'm like, don't start there. If you see it's becoming a problem, like, talk to somebody about it. Find resources, get involved, and that sort of thing. And you know, on that note, like, I know you say you don't say no. Are you taking clients right now? How do people find you? How do they connect with you? What's the story on families needing your services and how to get with you?
Yeah, I know. I really don't say no for the most part. I guess I can say, like, I'm always taking clients, right? They can find me. I'm on social media. That always works. That seems to be really easy for families. So on Instagram, my handle is @naturallydivergenttherapist, or you can find me on my website too. And that's at www.mccartytherapysolutions.com, and that's pretty easy. You can just send me a quick contact message and I get back to you pretty quickly on those too.
And the center's opening September, you say? That's the grand opening date?
Yes.
Seems pretty solid. You'll let us know.
Yep. Nope. That is our official day. We have some amazing speakers coming too. Like, I feel so grateful. We've got some amazing speakers. And if you want to follow the updates on our center, we have a website for the center as well. It's www.neurobloomcenter.com. And then also on our Instagram as well. And we're posting updates constantly for that. And you can check out our speakers and all that. It's going to be pretty awesome.
Now, is your book also out there in the ethers? Can they find it on, you know,
whatever platform
you buy things from?
Yeah, if you can find it on whatever platforms. It's also, it just released about a month ago or so for audiobook as well. So you can find it in audiobook form. I know I'm an audiobook person, so I was really happy when we did that. Yeah.
Who reads it for you?
Yeah, so I actually had somebody else read it for me. Her name is Her name is Melina Brinker. And it's really great because I was tired of my own voice. So I had somebody else do it. I was like, you guys don't need to hear me talk anymore. And she's absolutely wonderful. And she reads her own special note at the beginning. And honestly, like, I didn't know she was going to do that. It was a surprise. And it really was touching for me.